You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rātū Tuesday. I'm your host Kesta and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Sarah. If I can name coming up on the show, for Dear Science this week, our expert Professor Alan Blackman chats with us about lightning created by peeling tape, links between talc and cancer, and a new form of nitrogen. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Tom Rutherford, I ask about the government's health contributions in light of recent strikes. I also speak to Emeritus Professor Tim Hazeldine about David Seymour's plans to address the supermarket duopoly in Aotearoa. Sarah, what have you got for us today?
On the topic of the recent Economy of Genocide report released by UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese, I spoke with both University of Otago's Professor of International Relations Robert Patman, as well as Amnesty International Aotearoa's Margaret Taylor.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e ware ware e aha ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokidoki mārunga i te paitukutuku o Erirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Yes, and for Dear Science, we are joined, as I said earlier, by our expert once again, Professor Alan Blackman.
Always makes me laugh when you say that, but I can't let this moment go without telling the listening audience that this is Caster's last Tuesday Wire.
Yeah, so I guess my last time calling you any expert, though it will remain to be true, certainly after my departure from the Tuesday Wire.
Oh.
Yes, and our last Dear Science, which we've got some cracking stories to get to. Cracking. I guess that's the noise electricity makes.
Yes. I think that's nice.
Yeah, and segued well, and peeling tape creating chemical reactions. What is going on here?
This is absolutely nuts. Well, let's go back to 2010 and the Nobel Prize in Physics, which was a bit of a surprise to people because it was awarded for a method of making this thing called graphene.
Graphene.
Okay, so we all know graphite.
Yes.
Don't we? Okay, so that's pencil lead. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you take graphite, big sheet of graphite, and you put sticky tape on it, and you peel off the sticky tape, off the graphite, you get this single layer of graphite, basically. It's one atom thick.
Right.
And it looks like chicken wire, basically. A whole bunch of hexagons, looks like chicken wire. And they get it by putting sticky tape on graphite and peeling it off.
Sounds fairly simple.
This graphene is quite amazing stuff. But these guys won the Nobel Prize for basically using sticky tape to
it sounds easy enough.
And of course everybody wished that they'd thought of that first. And so sticky tape has uses, and so some people have been doing some recent experiments with sticky tape, so some folks in China and the US, and what they have shown is that when you peel a roll of sticky tape and you do it quite fast, you can generate some incredibly intense electric fields. Remarkable.
Right.
Absolutely remarkable. And in fact, what you can do is generate a thing called micro-lightning.
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 That sounds fun. I'd assume it's because of the static sort of...
Yeah.
Similar to rubbing a balloon on your hair.
Right? Yeah, indeed. And but, I mean, more amazing still. So this has been known for quite some time, in fact. So way back in 1939, you go back then, and it was found that you could get luminescence. So if you peel a sticky tape in a dark room, you'll see light.
That's fun.
Okay, so that means that, some large energies are involved there in order to generate light. You're generating excited atoms, which then generate light. And more amazing, and I did not know this, so in 2008 they found, and this just boggles the mind, that when you peel tape, you can actually generate X-rays. Now, X-rays are ridiculously high energy beasties. And so that sort of shows that what's going on when you're peeling tape is quite remarkable.
We're doing a bit of science in the home.
And absolutely. So X-rays, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
Oh, so what studies have shown is that when you are peeling the tape, the adhesive side, the side with the sticky stuff on it, that becomes positively charged. Okay, and then when you get a charge imbalance, then that's when we get things like lightning and,
right,
you know, all that sort of stuff, okay? And so that comes out as a result of these massive, massive, massive electric fields that you can get when you peel the tape at a decent rate. And it's also apparently the reason why when you're taking a bandage off, if you do it, the pain comes from that, or part of the pain comes from that as well. But we're talking big, big electric fields. We're talking 1 billion volts per meter.
Ow. So that does sound like one of the bad ones, right? You wouldn't want to be in contact with that.
No, you absolutely wouldn't. So then what happens is that positive charge ionizes the air. So you form ions in the air. You're ripping electrons off things, and then all of a sudden they sort of recombine, and bam, you get this big clap of lightning. Now, obviously we're not getting big claps of lightning when we're pulling the tape off, but that's what's actually happening. So these researchers in China and the States decided to investigate this more closely. And so they're using very, very, very high-tech equipment to measure just how big these electric fields are, and also what chemical species you get when you do this peeling in the area of the tape itself. So they're using, as I say, very, very high-tech stuff. And they basically found that they could easily generate enough energy to drive a chemical reaction just using peeling tape.
Wow.
It just absolutely boggles the mind. So X-rays, they're finding X-rays are about 100,000 electron volts, and for comparison, to drive a chemical reaction, you need about 10 electron volts.
So we're well over.
So, you know, just this physical process of just peeling tape, absolutely astonishing.
You'd never realise it.
No, had no idea.
Incredible stuff.
Remarkable. Yep.
In this next story about talcum cancer, I overstated or understated it, I guess. There's a bit more to it than just the talc and the cancer here.
Well, there is, and it's a long story, so sit tight, those of you out there listening. So in 2020, there was a paper published, and it had the very snappy title, Mesothelioma Associated with the Use of Cosmetic Talc. Now, I'm sure everybody listening has heard of talcum powder.
Obviously.
It's one of those things that gets used as much as sticky tape.
Yeah. Oh, very nice, very nice. And so this paper in 2020 was published in a thing called the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, and the authors were a bunch of folk from upstate New York, okay, and also from Mount Sinai as well. So lawyers for a very, very large pharmaceutical company, who we're not going to name, just in case, they have, in the last couple of months, asked for this paper to be retracted. Okay. And for a paper to be retracted, generally what you need to show is that the material in the paper is fraudulent.
You've got to show it's wrong,
It's wrong, or it's been made up, or whatever, demonstrably incorrect. All of those sorts of things. So why... You ask, might this company be doing this? Well, said company is in the process of being sued by thousands of people for literally billions of dollars for supposedly supplying talcum powder that was contaminated with asbestos.
Oh.
Okay, and we all know that asbestos is not good. And asbestos apparently leads to this cancer, mesothelioma. Okay.
Right.
So, the study in the paper was of 33 people, or 33 cases, let's say, of malignant mesothelioma. And what the participants all had in common was that they had not been exposed to any other source of asbestos except for supposedly the stuff that was in the talcum powder, okay? Now, what the authors found was that after they published the paper, they found that one individual had in fact smoked cigarettes that had filters that were contaminated with asbestos. So,
right.
So they did have another source of asbestos that they had come into contact with. Okay, and so then the company said, "Well, hang on a minute. You know, we're being sued by these people, and indeed the lead author has been used as an expert witness
right.
in some of these cases." Okay, so there lies the sort of the connection.
Mm.
So the big company went to the court, and then the court said, okay, these 33 people, you've got to give us their names. Okay, you've got to make them public.
Right.
Because of the fact that we've got this ongoing litigation and everything, and then the company can then look at these people and see whether any other of them had exposure to asbestos elsewhere other than the talc. And that's not normally a thing that is done.
No, I'd imagine confidentiality is quite important.
Yeah, but, you know, this is court-ordered, so they did this. And now the company, having looked at these names, they now say that there are at least five, I believe, more people who have had other exposures to asbestos. And so this is sort of the reason that they're wanting this paper retracted. Now, so this all comes this all comes down to the head of the poor old journal editor, who probably never comes across something like this in his daily work. This would be very, very, very unusual. So the journal editor has sort of weighed up the pros and the cons and everything. He's looked, and most importantly, what he's looking at is the science itself and how the science was carried out and how it was reported. And basically he's come to the conclusion that we're not going to retract the paper because, as far as I'm concerned, everything seems to have been above board, done correctly,
valid.
And so the lead author, as a result of this, is now being sued by the pharmaceutical company as well. So again, that's, you know, wow.
It's growing more and more complex.
It is, absolutely it is, and that's sort of where it stands at the moment. So the, you know, the requested retraction has not occurred. The pharmaceutical company is now suing the lead author, and basically there it stands.
Yeah.
Has there not been any other research that's verified these same outcomes?
That's a really good question. Personally, you wouldn't probably want to go near this with a barge pole, really.
I'd imagine,
You know, given what is happening at the moment. And, you know, remember that, you know, companies have very deep pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sort of defending yourself against this sort of stuff would be, not a great place to be in.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, somebody needs to look at the truth of all of this, you know. And it needs to be investigated very, very carefully, obviously, because, you know, there are literally, as I say, billions of dollars involved.
100%.
And obviously people's lives have been lost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the question then needs to be asked, was it as a result of this accidental exposure to asbestos that is supposedly in the talcum powder, you know? So, that's where it is. That's where it is. And as we often say, you know, watch the space, more to come, most definitely. Yeah.
And then this last one, something far more common than talc and sticky tape, of course, nitrogen, right?
Nitrogen, absolutely.
Everywhere.
Yes.
And we're making a new one?
We are, yeah. And so nitrogen makes up basically 80% of the air that we breathe. So every breath we take, 4/5 of it is nitrogen, essentially. Okay, so it's an important element. And speaking of elements, we need to define this a term that maybe you might not have heard of. This thing called an allotrope.
Allotrope.
An allotrope, okay. Which are basically different forms of the same element.
Hmm.
Okay, and so the most famous allotrope allotropes that people would know of, and we've already mentioned one of them today, graphite and diamond.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So graphite and diamond are different forms of carbon.
Yeah.
So they're just made up of carbon atoms, but the extraordinary thing is that the carbon atoms are just arranged differently.
Yeah, and so they look more fun.
And in doing that, you go from something that is sort of grey and very, very slippery to something that is transparent and really, really, and the hardest thing that we know,
right?
Basically. And that all has to do simply with the way that the carbon atoms are arranged, which, again, never fails to amaze me. And there are other examples of allotropes as well. Phosphorus might be one that you've heard of. You can get white phosphorus, you can get red phphosphorus, you can get black phosphorus, and they all differ, and they've got very, very different properties, just like
graphite. Are these things that you create or that are discovered?
You can do either. I mean, graphite and diamond both exist out there in the real world. So do these allotropes of phosphorus. You can, or more so, you'd tend to make those in the lab probably. Good old nitrogen. So the only way that we know nitrogen at the moment, or up until a wee while ago, was nitrogen as a gas. And nitrogen as a gas consists of two nitrogen atoms, and they are bonded together with a really, 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 really strong bond.
Got it.
And they exist in bulk as a gas, okay, at room temperature. If you cool it down enough, you can turn it into a liquid. And if you cool it down even further, you can turn it into a solid. But we are familiar with nitrogen as being a gas.
Yeah.
With the chemical formula N2.
N2.
Okay, two atoms of nitrogen
Seems fairly straightforward.
Per molecule.
Yeah.
But now some workers in Germany have decided that, no, they really wouldn't miss their fingers and toes and limbs and stuff like that. And they decided to try and make another allotrope of nitrogen. And they've succeeded. And now they've made nitrogen with a chemical formula N6.
That's fun.
With six atoms of nitrogen.
How does this differ?
How does it differ? Well, it's a solid at not so much room temperature, but certainly at liquid nitrogen temperature. So they cool it down quite a lot.
Right.
At room temperature, it's basically decomposes in milliseconds.
Got it.
But
okay.
If you cool it down, you can get it to basically be relatively stable, and you can make a film of it at 77 Kelvin.
That's okay. Fun.
And so they've basically isolated it, and they've basically shown that, yep, this is the real stuff. So we've made a brand new allotrope of nitrogen. Only trouble is, as would be expected, it is, when it decomposes, it releases a hell of a lot of energy.
Right.
And nitrogen is the basis of pretty much all explosives.
Got it. So that when we're releasing energy, it's not like a fun sort of release of energy. It's a...
Oh, no, boom. It's a violent...
Yeah,
yes,
got
yes,
it. Okay.
Yes, it's a violent release of energy because nitrogen desperately wants to form nitrogen molecules N2.
Right.
And it'll do anything like that it can. So that's why explosives very often contain lots of nitrogen.
Got it.
And that's why these workers are just crazy, because they've got now molecules that contain six nitrogen atoms and nothing else.
And what do you do with that? Like, once, if you want to dispose it, do you just have to let it explode?
Oh, probably just warm it up to room temperature and it'll go, you know?
Got it, right,
It'll be gone.
Is it useful for anything?
Oh, they're talking about energy storage, and they've got to come up with some use for it and everything. But no, it's fundamental chemistry.
Yeah, we've just proven that we can do it.
Awesome. Yeah, exactly. To prove that we can do it, and we're furthering knowledge, basically. So
that's quite fun.
It's nice. It's really nice stuff. And again, I'm amazed that people haven't lost a few fingers and everything to this, because the Germans seem to have a propensity for studying these things with lots of nitrogen in them. And when the stuff decomposes, it releases twice as much energy as the equivalent mass of TNT.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's quite violent.
Just quickly returning back to the tape story.
Yeah.
Someone's asked, does this release of energy happen just with sellotape, or can it be achieved with any kind of adhesive tape, duct tape or packaging tape, for instance?
My guess is that it probably would be for all of them. That's just a guess. Okay?
Yeah.
But my feeling is that that's probably going to be a general sort of thing, any sort of adhesive. Yeah.
You can always check it up with the original stories on the Dear Science podcast.
Absolutely.
On the BFM website.
Yep.
Which you can catch later today. All right. Well, for the last time, I guess.
Oh, God, no. Here come the tears. Jeez, I'm bad at goodbyes. But thank you, Castor. Yeah. It's been an absolute pleasure working with you. And you always ask those incisive questions that make me go, So,
Thank you. Thank you for coming in this week and over the past year that I've been, or more than a year that I've been doing this. Thank you, as always, to Mojet. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
They say that fashion is art, and you, lovely listeners, are the canvas.
B-merch. That's right. We've been in the lab designing some sexy new merch for you to stay hot when it's cold and cool as hell when it's hot.
We've got new tees, hoodies, the classic BSA slogan, and a limited edition t-shirt of BFM's iconic weatherman, Rick Breeze.
So run, don't walk. twotonesmerch.co.nz and get your grubby little mitts on the hottest new 95 BFM merch.
Decalcify your pineal gland live on broadcast radio. It's a contact lens for your third eye, a pacemaker for your anahata chakra.
Rehabilitate your aura with Aaron on Psychic Glands. Delicate, psychedelic, transcendent, blissful.
Psychic Glands, every Thursday, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on 95BFM and available eternally on podcast and RSS at 95BFM.com.
Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums, and more.
I'm not gonna die on this hill, or maybe I will. Summer's over, it's sad, but I'm still burning bad. Can't keep calling it grief, or hoping it's brief when you live in the world. But I live underneath, who will water the plants? Are they just gonna be another thing that dies from spending time around me?
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Tom Rutherford.
Welcome back to The Wire. Last week, Pharmac workers announced their first ever strike over cuts to annual pay increases and deteriorating work conditions. Also last week, the New Zealand Nurses Organisation announced plans to strike on July 30th. The nurses' strike follows concerns around understaffing and overcrowding in the health system, with many staff members facing burnout. These two issues have been attributed to similar causes, not enough funding in the health sector, which is forcing redundancies, increased hours, and understaffing. While the government has committed extra funding to the health sector in the last two budgets, critics say the funding is inadequate and barely catching up to existing deficits. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I asked Tom Rutherford about health funding and the government's plans moving forward in light of the two recently announced health workers' strikes. So today we're starting off with two strikes in Aotearoa's health sector. Beginning with the first ever Pharmac strike last week, the government has announced over its term several changes, funding boosts and restructures to Pharmac. Have these decisions led to their intended outcomes?
In regards to the Pharmac strikes, or are you talking about changes in Pharmac?
Just generally, have the changes to Pharmac led to their intended outcomes?
Yeah, I think Pharmac is a really improving its performance since we've come into government. You'll obviously see we've made some changes in that space. David Seymour, as the Associate Minister of Health, has responsibility for Pharmac. You'll remember, for example, after last year's budget, we put in a significant amount of money into Pharmac to fund new cancer drugs, which have gone a really long way to supporting people across New Zealand and ensuring they get the medication and support that they need. And yeah, we're ensuring that Pharmac is a well-performing agency of the government and is doing its work across the country to support the people who need it. There's always more room for improvement, but yes, they're certainly turning themselves around since we've come into government.
The issues identified by the striking workers appear to stem from a lack of funding to the organisation, with workers seeing cuts to annual pay increases and deterioration of work conditions. Will the government consider further funding to Pharmac to address this issue?
Yeah, I think that'll be a consideration that the Associate Minister of Health will be taking seriously and be taking advice on. I'd hate to speak out of turn on information that he'll be privy to, but I'm sure that'll be a consideration for him. But he'll be wanting to make sure also that Pharmac is a well-performing agency and is doing its best to support New Zealanders and getting the support to everybody that they need.
We've also seen over 36,000 nurses, midwives, healthcare assistants and kaimahi hauora from Te Whatu Ora voting to strike later this month, following accusations that Health NZ is not including a safe staffing agreement in its contract offer, among other issues. The nurses' organisation says this indicates a focus on cost rather than safety. Will the government commit more funding to Te Whatu Ora to address these issues of costs rising and not enough funding?
Yeah, it is incredibly disappointing to hear that the New Zealand Nurses Organisation Union has chosen to strike later this month. This will not solve the pressures in our health system, it'll only actually cause harm to patients. Thousands of New Zealanders will face disruption as a result of this action. Across the country, the strike is expected to cancel or postpone 1,500 elective surgeries and arranged treatments, delay 2,800 first specialist assessment, disrupt radiology procedures, and a lot more as well. The average nurse has a take-home pay of more than $125,000 a year, inclusive of overtime and allowances, and this is similar to salaries paid to nurses overseas, such as in New South Wales. And additionally, since 2011, pay for NZNO union nurses has increased by almost 74%, well ahead of wage growth across the wider economy, which has increased by 35% according to the Labour Cost Index over the same period.
I think the issue that the nurses' organisation is looking at the moment and the issues that they've pointed out in their announcement to strike are that there's a lot of understaffing and overcrowding in these hospital environments that, you know, despite any of the pay that they might be getting, this is burning people out and it's risking safety for patients. And, you know, as you pointed out, the strike will also have some safety risks, but I think that's more speaking to the urgency of this issue and the fact that we're seeing these safety risks every day. How is the government addressing this urgent issue?
Yeah, I think the strike is a choice by the NZNO union, which is putting politics ahead of patients. The strike will not reduce wait lists or improve patient care, and it'll only worsen delays for New Zealanders who are already waiting too long for treatment. Health New Zealand remains at the table, ready to negotiate in good faith. And the offer on the table will see a new graduate nurse on $75,773 gain a total pay increase of $8,337 by the end of June 2026, inclusive of step progression. The union should all return to talks and put patients first. Walking off the job does not solve anything. It simply harms the very people who need care the most.
Right, but I mean, if we're looking at reducing wait lists and improving patient care, as you mentioned, what is the government doing? I mean, as the nurses' organisation has said, the pay is not the issue there. So what is the government doing to reduce wait lists and improve patient care?
Yeah, our government is also investing significantly in our nursing workforce. So in Budget 2025, we supported 400 nurses each year to start their careers in primary care with payments of $15,000 to primary care providers in urban areas for each graduate nurse they employ and $20,000 in rural areas. We've also got funding to train 120 nurse practitioners each year in primary care and funding to upskill 60 nurses each year in primary care to become nurse prescribers. We remain focused on reducing wait times and delivering timely quality healthcare, and we recognise that nurses are essential to this work, and we want to thank those who will continue to work hard for Kiwis needing care. There's still time to step back from the strike and do what is right for patients.
But the strike, again, it's following these issues in the short term, right? This overcrowding and understaffing, and the changes that you mentioned, while they're going to contribute to this issue in the long term, they might not be able to alleviate that pressure in the health sector now. So I guess what is the government doing urgently in the short term to address these issues that are directly affecting patients right now?
Well, we've got a lot of initiatives in the pipeline that we're working on and that we've delivered already since coming into government 18 months or so ago. Obviously, things take time to deliver as well, but as I've talked about, we're supporting 400 additional nurses each year to start their careers in primary care. We've got funding to train additional nurse practitioners each year and funding to upskill additional nurses each year in primary care to become nurse prescribers. We've also, you know, as we've said, Health New Zealand is at the table ready to negotiate in good faith, and my suggestion would be that there's still time to step back from the strike and do what is right for patients and come back to the table to negotiate with Health New Zealand.
And with those funding boosts in the last two budgets, obviously we've seen those have an impact in the health sector, but some of those within the sector and Labour's Aisha Verrill as well say that the government is still playing catch-up with costs in the health sector steadily increasing, and they have been steadily increasing faster than funding is being provided and allocated. In the long term, you know, what is the government doing to address the rising costs that we're seeing, and how is that going to affect future governments in Aotearoa?
Yeah, so I wouldn't take much advice from Aisha Verrill. She's put our health system into the situation that it is at the moment, for example, doing a mega multi-merger during a pandemic, which is not something anyone would really recommend as a particularly good idea. What we're doing is saying that we want to empower our nurses. We want them to come back to the table to negotiate with Health New Zealand on this. We've put additional funding into our nursing workforce in Budget 2025 so that we can grow our workforce across New Zealand so that people can get the timely and quality care that they deserve. If I think about my home patch, for example, in the Bay of Plenty, we got a funding allocation through this budget that allowed for us to have a new urgent and after-hours medical care open in our community from next year. That's going to be fantastic for my community. That will take pressure off our local hospital and A&E and actually save people money as well. And so that'll be a really positive outcome for my local Bay of Plenty community, and that's the case across New Zealand as well. So there's lots of different initiatives happening in health which have really positive outcomes for people. Yes, they take time to deliver, but we know that most importantly, people want to know there's health services there available for them when they need it, and so they can get the timely and quality care that they deserve.
That was the National Party's Tom Rutherford speaking to me about health funding and health workers' strikes.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Tom Rutherford.
This is why we should never put celebrities in charge of any... Oh, wait.
The Wire.
ACT Party leader David Seymour announced plans to address the supermarket duopoly at the ACT Party summit on Sunday. Seymour proposed that international competitors haven't begun operations in New Zealand due to restrictive approvals processes. Seymour says while his opponents have proposed breaking up the duopoly or imposing taxes, his solution of introducing a third private competitor would be the only truly effective answer. I speak to Emeritus Professor of Economics Tim Hazelden about his thoughts on Seymour's proposal and alternative solutions to break up the New Zealand supermarket duopoly. So ACT's David Seymour says his party has plans to break up the supermarket duopoly by introducing competition and reducing approval processes. Before we get into this proposal and others, how does the supermarket duopoly affect consumers in Aotearoa?
It probably puts the prices up, to put it simply, that we pay more for our groceries because we've only got two competing big supermarket chains, Foodstuffs and Woolworths. The idea is that if you have a third competitor, three is more, they compete a bit harder with each other and shave their profit margins a bit to the benefit of our families and consumers.
How would David Seymour's plan work in practice?
I mean, Seymour's in a tricky spot. He's not so right. He's a right-wing politician, correct? But he's not so right-wing that he's like Ayn Rand and says, markets work fine. You know, supermarkets deserve their profits. Go grow your own potatoes if you don't like it. So he sort of concedes that there is a competition problem in supermarkets, in the $20, $30 billion a year supermarket industry. But being quite right-wing, he'd rather find a way of dealing with it which reduces government involvement than increases it. So he's spoken against this conventional interventionist Commerce Commission type breaking up duopoly, perhaps making foodstuffs North Island and foodstuffs South Island separate and competing with each other. He doesn't like that because it's interference in markets. So what's he going to do? Is there anything that government could stop doing that would bring a third competitor into the market? And so he says, well, why don't we just promise any Aldi or Tesco or Walmart or whatever that will fast-track their approvals if they seek to enter the New Zealand market. But that's what he's come up with.
Have we seen any indication from these foreign supermarket chains that you mentioned that they'd like to set up in Aotearoa?
That's exactly the right question. No, there's absolutely no interest being shown by Aldi in particular, which is, does operate in Australia, certainly not Walmart, to set up in New Zealand. So he's pretending that these big giants have been put off coming to New Zealand because of getting resource consent or the a bit of red tape or whatever, and promising to sweep aside the red tape so they'll come bursting in. Well, it's just a fantasy.
And if we're thinking about other ways to address the supermarket duopoly, there's been multiple solutions discussed. You mentioned breaking up the duopoly. How could the government break up the duopoly in Aotearoa?
Well, there are actually three firms there, because Foodstuffs, which runs New World and Pack and Save, is two separate, legally separate cooperatives. Foodstuffs North Island, which runs all the North Island stores, Foodstuffs South Island. Okay, they applied to merge last year or the year before, and the Commerce Commission wouldn't let them because they are competing at the moment on the supply side, competing to buy their products and their potatoes and everything else. And the Commerce Commission didn't want that to stop. But it could make them compete downstream in the actual supermarkets where we buy our food, our groceries, by perhaps saying, well, we want to mix you up a bit. We want Foodstuffs North Island to sell some of its or transfer some of its North Island supermarkets to Foodstuffs South Island, and vice versa, so that in, at least in bigger cities would have three separate supermarket chains, including Woolworths, competing with each other. That's what they could do. The other thing that the government could do, well, Commerce Commission, was set up Kiwi stores, set up their own publicly run, either the government or local bodies, stores, to probably in low-income areas, to give low-income people an alternative choice of where to buy their food and groceries at a better price.
Yeah, and we've seen that plan talked about in New York by the Democratic mayoral candidate there, Zora Mamdani, to open these publicly run supermarkets. We've also seen, you know, criticisms of this plan that the government could lose money in the business, or that the government should introduce a private competitor or focus on introducing a private competitor rather than a public one. How would you respond to these criticisms?
I think we should have I read that story too, and I didn't realise that such stores do exist in some US cities already. And so I'd be quite interested to follow that up and see how they run. They shouldn't, obviously, they don't need to be subsidised. They just need to make lower profit margins than the big private supermarkets do. And so there needn't be a cash cost thing there. I mean, he also wants to bring in free public transit, right? Well, that's lovely, but that's definitely going to cost somebody some money. But running Kiwi stores or running grocery stores in low-income areas on a sort of very low profit margin basis wouldn't require subsidies.
Mm. And so, I mean, even if we wouldn't see subsidies there, there could be a lot of antagonism towards this idea by, you know, David Seymour and by the national government and the current coalition government. Why is there antagonism towards this idea, and how would you respond to their criticisms?
Well, and it's all of them. I don't see the Greens. The Greens might propose this, but I don't think Labor has. Oh, they're all... For 40 years now, New Zealand has been one of the most neoliberal countries in the world, ever since Roger Nobbock. And they just sort of... free market or so-called free market economics just dominates their thinking, and they've lost their sort of nerve as governments to actually act themselves proactively in the economy. They think they're doomed to be inefficient or stupid or whatever, and the private sector is smarter than the public sector. Well, I think we should query some of that, especially in New Zealand, where we've got lots of, in the energy sector and other places, we've got lots of joint ventures, parts are 51%, like in New Zealand, 51% owned by the government, 49% private, and it's a very good company. Works very well. So I think we should be ready to, I think our governments or our political parties, whether they're governments now or not, should be willing to consider these things.
That was Emeritus Professor of Economics Tim Hazelden speaking to me about David Seymour's plans to break up the New Zealand supermarket duopoly.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Earlier this month, UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, submitted a report to the UN Human Rights Council entitled From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. The report names companies who have financially supported or sustained Israel's ongoing war and genocide against Palestinians and highlights pathways to accountability that transcend legal and diplomatic rhetoric. She calls on civil society to respond to the actions of Israel in light of the limited power of the United Nations to effectively end the violence. The United States has since imposed sanctions on Albanese, calling for her removal for her allegations they say are false and offensive. Exploring more in depth the potential impact of this Economy of Genocide report, as well as the obligation and power of the United Nations as a whole and the New Zealand government to respond to the situation, I spoke with University of Otago Professor for Politics and International Relations Robert Patman, as well as Amnesty International Aotearoa Community Manager Margaret Taylor. Patman has published two pieces recently criticizing the New Zealand government's failure to adequately respond to the US's role in particular in the violence in Gaza. Here is our interview. What impact do you think this report has on the international discourse around Israeli actions, as well as the United Nations' role in the condemnation of acts of violence?
Potentially, yeah, it has a significant impact. Francesca Albanese has been, I think, very courageous in her role, and has courageously pointed out that the Israeli response to the dreadful terrorist attack on the 7th of October 2023 was disproportionate and inconsistent with humanitarian law. And this introduces a new dimension, because I think Albanese has been very forthright, and of course occurred the displeasure of both the United States, which has been complicit in the military onslaught orchestrated by the Netanyahu government in Gaza. What is it significant about this recent report is it shows the degree to which not just the United States government, but a whole series of commercial organizations, including organizations like Google, are implicated and indeed enabling the Israeli policy towards Gaza and indeed the West Bank. You know, there's a natural focus on Gaza, where there's a humanitarian crisis and also a relentless military onslaught. But it should be pointed out that more than 1,000 Palestinians have died in West Bank, in the West Bank area. These are both illegally occupied by Israel under international law, both the West Bank and Gaza. And so I think the Albanese's report is that it draws attention to a number of high-profile commercial organisations that are working closely with the Netanyahu government.
In light of this report, what power does the United Nations or members of the United Nations really have to respond to and tangibly condemn Israel for their acts of genocide in Gaza?
Limited, and let's be quite clear, the United States has now sanctioned Albanese for this report, and there are restrictions on her ability to work in New York. So it clearly has stung, but I think it has placed a certain amount of power now in the hands of consumers, because some people will be unaware of the involvement of many large corporations and companies in what is happening in both Gaza and the West Bank, and may start to put pressure on those organizations to desist or face the possibility that people will simply vote with their feet and not invest or buy products from that company. And that's a serious concern for many commercial organizations. So as a member of the UN or a UN special rapporteur, I think Francesca Albanese's powers are limited, but don't underestimate the power of ideas and the ability to stand up for them, because it's quite clear that the majority of countries in the world, we're talking consistently about more than two-thirds of the members of the UN General Assembly, have voted for an immediate ceasefire since the 27th of October 2023, just, you know, about 20 days or 3 weeks into the conflict there. So it seems to me it's difficult to give a sort of precise answer to the question of how limited will the impact of this report be limited. It could be limited in the short term, but it may play a significant role in the long term, depending on how people respond. It's certainly a warning shot to the Netanyahu government that since a number of companies which have been supporting Netanyahu government have been served notice that the world is watching them, that has commercial implications for them. It also has implications for the Netanyahu government. But there doesn't seem to be any indication the Netanyahu government will respond. It has contempt for the UN and has basically called at one point for the resignation of the UN Secretary General. One of the biggest problems facing the UN is the fact that five countries have a privilege that no others have in the UN Security Council. And the UN Security Council is the major decision-making body in the UN. Its resolutions are binding. Unfortunately, five countries, that's the United States, Russia, China, the UK and France, have something called the veto, which enables them to block anything they don't like. That is why the UN was marginalized and sidelined during the horrendous conflict in Gaza, which has been ongoing more or less since October 2023.
Do you think the New Zealand government should or even could be doing more in diplomatic opposition to especially the US's role in this conflict?
The New Zealand government, its role has been ambivalent. On the one hand, in the UN, it was one of the only member of the Five Eyes to call for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire on the 27th of October 2023, which was a resolution passed by the UN General Assembly. It was subsequently joined in that endeavour, calling for a ceasefire, by Australia and Canada. So in the UN, when it comes to voting the General Assembly, it also voted to support the International Court of Justice advisory. It voted in September 2024 for a ruling from the International Court to support the idea that the occupation of East Jerusalem, Gaza, and the West Bank was unlawful. So New Zealand, that is New Zealand's official position, that the occupied territories are occupied illegally. But your question's a good one, because in principle, New Zealand has, within the UN, it's been quite positive in support of upholding the rules-based international order. But in practice, it is sometimes been reluctant to speak up outside the UN to uphold those principles. It remained relatively quiet, for example, when Mr. Trump floated the idea of Gaza being American-owned and a proposal which implied that the Palestinians should be evicted. It's also been quite ambivalent during the Iran, the conflict, but the preemptive attacks by Israel, nuclear-armed Israel and nuclear-armed the United States on Iran. The Iranian regime is appalling, but let's be quite clear, according to US intelligence and according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, both of those organizations, the IAEA and also US intelligence, believe that Iran is nowhere near having nuclear weapons at the moment. And so when it comes down to international law, the preemptive attacks by first Israel and then the United States on Iran's nuclear facilities were flagrant violations of international law. Did New Zealand say anything? No, it didn't. In fact, Mr. Peters said New Zealand would remain neutral on an issue in which there had been a systematic breach of international law. So to sum up, it's a mixed picture. And I think there is a sense of frustration that New Zealand probably has not walked the talk on its stance towards the Middle East. It seems to have been very concerned not to offend the Trump administration.
You've made the argument before that New Zealand's commitments under Te Tiriti o Waitangi should hold us morally responsible in relation to human rights in the Middle East. Do you think that that would have any weight on the international stage? I suppose you've already talked about that a little bit.
Well, I think that the fact that this country was founded on a treaty between settlers and the indigenous people, the treaty has been imperfectly implemented. We all know that. But it nevertheless, I think, is an important precedent. And it's particularly important in the context of the relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians, where there is a number of territories where Palestinians live, which are occupied and being settled by Israelis. I think New Zealand's authority derives from that. It does present a different model of how relations between indigenous and settlers can be handled. But more importantly, I think New Zealand needs to speak up for people who do not have statehood and do not have a voice on the international stage. And one way of doing that is for this government to pick up where other governments have, certainly the key government, attempted to make some progress. What was the area I'm talking about? Reform of the UN Security Council, constraining of the veto. The key government certainly tried to make some progress with that, as did Bill English as well. When New Zealand was on the United Nations Security Council, it took steps, which turned out to be unsuccessful, to constrain the use of the veto. Let's be quite clear. It's unacceptable to most countries in the world in the 21st century that questions of war and peace rest on the shoulders of just five countries. That means that five countries can block anything they don't like internationally. And it's the rest of the world that's paying the price for that privilege. And I think New Zealand's position should be to put together or try to lead a coalition of countries demanding that the UN Security Council become more functional. And that means constraining the use of the veto. The veto doesn't necessarily have to be abolished. There are other ways of curbing its use. For example, you could empower the UN General Assembly so that when there's a vote in the UN General Assembly by more than two-thirds of its members, then that would overrule any veto by the UN Security Council. If we think back to October 27, 2023, there was a vote on that day in the UN General Assembly for a resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian truce. More than two-thirds of the membership of the UN voted for that resolution. But that resolution was non-binding, and it did nothing to dilute the use, the consistent use of vetoes by the US in the UN Security Council to prevent a ceasefire. So we're in a situation, had the UN General Assembly had more authority, they could have enforced a ceasefire. That is to say, if we had a new rule change in the UN whereby any measure which commands more than two-thirds of the membership of the UN General Assembly, that should overrule any veto by a single state in the UN Security Council. And that rule change could be carried out. Just think of the difference would have occurred had that been in place at the end of October in 2023. A lot of innocent lives would have been saved. And it's not just Gaza. We have a ridiculous situation in Ukraine where Russia abused its position as a veto-wielding member of the UN when it invaded Ukraine. And it effectively vetoed any condemnation of its own invasion of a sovereign state, which is Ukraine. So at the moment, the UN Security Council is dysfunctional. I think New Zealand's role, which would make a big difference to both the Middle East and places like Ukraine, would be to try to, if you like, reinvigorate a campaign to lead to UN reform and make the UN much more functional in what is, after all, an increasingly interconnected world.
My final question for you in that regard, in response to this report, would you, with the limited, authority of the United Nations, would you say the burden of responsibility to hold businesses and financial supporters of genocide or violence accountable lies more with governments through legislative or diplomatic action, or with individuals through consumption choices and protests?
Well, I think particularly with liberal democratic governments like our own, people can put pressure on their government to change their policies if they feel that the policies are inappropriate. You know, problems created by human beings can be fixed by them. There's nothing inevitable here. The UN at the moment has been marginalised and is largely impotent. And that's ironic because in the world we live where problems are too big for nation states to solve, I mean, that is the irony of the current situation. We have five countries in the UN Security Council. They can block any international proposal they don't like. But in most cases, they can't put anything in its place. So we fall between two stools. We can't get international solutions through the UN, and the countries involved, the permanent members of the five, they can't impose their own solutions. And so we're in a sort of, falling between stool all the time. I do believe that the initiative by Francesca Albanese is important and potentially influential. And I do think the consumers do have some, and citizens generally do have some influence if they choose to exercise it. But at the moment, you know, we have a vacuum in global leadership. That's the reality of the situation. We do not have an authoritative UN, and superpowers are confronted with problems that are too big for them to solve, but they're in denial about it. And the idea that you can normalize the situation between Israel and many of its Arab neighbors and not address the core issue, which is the Palestinian desire for political self-determination, it won't work. And the question that I think some Israeli citizens are beginning to ask now, is Israel more secure 18 months into this military campaign in Gaza than they were before this process began? And it's a hard question and is not easily answered.
I also spoke with Amnesty International's Margaret Taylor more about Albanese's report and the New Zealand government's obligations to human rights.
The Wire.
Do you believe that this report on the economy of genocide could be influential in shifting global discourse and negotiations surrounding Israel's actions?
Look, I certainly hope so, because it very clearly says that people are making money out of Israel's genocide. So the message is that has got to stop, but particularly it is targeting and corporates and businesses. And corporates and businesses need to know that they are also obligated to uphold human rights, and if they don't, they can be held accountable for human rights abuses.
How do you think the New Zealand government should be responding to this report, which highlights how direct corporate involvement underpins the tangible capacity for violence to continue in Gaza?
Yes, well, the New Zealand government has been missing in action on so many fronts when it comes to calling out Israel's genocide in Gaza and also its apartheid in occupied Palestinian territory. So not only is this report calling on the New Zealand government, amongst all governments, to impose sanctions and an arms embargo on Israel, and that's something that Amnesty also has long been calling for, but this report is calling on them to suspend all trade agreements and investment relations and impose sanctions, including asset freezes, on entities and individuals involved in activities that may endanger Palestinians, and to enforce accountability on corporate entities. So it's making some very clear recommendations to the New Zealand government, some of which we have already made to them, and they do need to be heeded. So in addition to this report, Amnesty is also calling on the New Zealand government to ban imports from illegal settlements, as well as investments in companies connected to maintaining the occupation, but also it should help Palestinian people seeking refuge to come here to Aotearoa, New Zealand, and receive support and safety.
I just wanted to ask there as well, could you talk a bit more about some of these recommendations that Amnesty has been making to the government and how they might be able to influence, I suppose, what's happening in this situation?
Well, this government alleges that it upholds the rule of law, and so it should. As a smaller country, it is best if we do uphold the rule of law, and which is why we have consistently called on it to call out Israel's genocide, and we put out a report at the end of December last year. And in 2022, we also highlighted Israel's apartheid in occupied Palestinian territory. So the New Zealand government needs to show leadership and call out both Israel's genocide and apartheid.
Beyond condemnation or perhaps sanctions even, is there a further obligation of New Zealand and other countries who are members of the United Nations to stand against this genocide?
Yeah, there's many ways to do it. I mean, they must call for that global arms embargo. But also New Zealand is one of the strongest nations in support of the International Criminal Court, and they can ensure that, because the International Criminal Court has got outstanding warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, who is a former IDF leader. They must ensure that, this is New Zealand must ensure that it continues to support the ICC and its calls for justice here. So that's definitely a way that they can be much stronger than they are right now.
How do you think the New Zealand government should respond to US sanctions placed on Francesca Albanese as a result of this report?
Well, the New Zealand government needs to push back as firmly as it can. Those sanctions are shameful and need to be challenged by each and every government, particularly a government like the New Zealand government, which says it respects the rule of law. Additionally, those sanctions have also been applied to the International Criminal Court, and New Zealand was an early adopter of the International Criminal Court and a champion court. So the New Zealand government needs to continue championing both human rights defenders like Francesca Albanese, who is absolutely extraordinary, and that role is unpaid. But the New Zealand government must also champion the ICC and make sure it's free to do its job without sanctions.
Finally, how would you compare the role of governments in responding to this situation on a diplomatic level with the role of individuals in regard to their power to make ethical consumption choices that recognise the involvement of certain corporations in financially sustaining war efforts?
Well, the point I'd like to make first is that mostly global leaders have been missing in action when it comes to calling out Israel's genocide. But the people that are showing the leadership in their tens of thousands and their millions, they're taking to the streets and they are protesting every day, every weekend, in very many ways. So the leadership is coming from the people, and they are also showing leadership when it comes to choosing what to buy and what not to buy if it has the taint from Israel. So I think there is a power in having those, I suppose, sanctions that come from the people. But I would also encourage and urge every Kiwi and all your listeners to pick up the phone, talk to their MP today and say New Zealand's actions are not good enough. They need to step up and hold Israel to account.
That was Amnesty International Community Manager Margaret Taylor and University of Otago International Politics Professor Robert Patman on Francesca Albanese's Economy of Genocide report submitted to the United Nations.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, the National Party's Tom Rutherford, Emeritus Professor Tim Hazeldean, and Amnesty International Community Manager Margaret Taylor, and the University of Otago's International Politics Professor Robert Patman. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongana. Thanks for tuning in to my last wire. Thank you for all the texts as well. I'll be around the station still. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.